Well, now to Australian politics, indeed politics internationally. You know, I used to do this for a job and I'm confused. Things are changing so fast. It is very, very hard to keep a tap on what is actually happening and who thinks what. Joining us now to hopefully clarify some of that is David Birchall from the University of Technology in Western Sydney. David, welcome back to Counterpoint.
Thanks, Amanda. Yeah, we're all confused.
We are.
Yeah, Western Sydney University, by the way. But yeah, we're confusion on numerous levels. Obviously, it strikes me, actually, as someone who grew up in the left, as it were, it's a very reminiscent time to the years after the Russian Revolution, the beginning of the 20th century, when things that happened in one other country suddenly have flowed through effects to everywhere else. That
yeah.
seems to be what's happening in America and parts of, well, all of Western Central Europe right now seems to flow through to us, and I think to everywhere in the Western world, where it's thrown the spectre up in the air, no one knows what's right and what's left, what's up and what's down anymore. And people are behaving a bit crazy, really.
So, okay, I think you and I can agree on that, but how do we explain it?
Well, in terms of America, and well, I mean, if you were going to be really crude about it, you'd say Western politics and Western economies are in trouble. And America is the most obvious example of that because it's the biggest, proudest, greatest country the world ever knew, as they remind themselves, and yet it's been in a, it is now clearly in a situation of decline, and parts of the electorate are very unhappy about that and have a strong perception of that, and it seems to have turned their politics upside down, particularly, I think, on the centre-right, where everything is in flux, and people who called themselves conservatives 12 months ago now seem to be Trumpians, and people who said they were all for free trade a year or two ago are now ardent economic nationalists. And I have to say, as someone who's watched politics in this country and around the world for quite some time, that's astonishing. And I find it very strange. A bit like, you know, the way people on the left behave so weirdly in relation to the Soviet Union for so long. How people had particular political ideals.
Hold on.
Yeah, yeah.
What do you mean by that? People on the left behaved so strangely to the Soviet Union?
Well, I think what happened, there was a Soviet effect where everyone on the left had to either have a position in relation to it. And many people, otherwise sensible people, were sucked into the entire Soviet mystique in a bizarre way. You know, as we all know, you know, comfortably off people in the West imagined that they wanted to work on a collective farm in the Soviet Union. Not that they ever moved there.
That was a key point to make there, isn't it?
Yeah, you know, that's right.
Not too many people that were advocating that as a great new way of life hopped on a boat or a plane and arrived in the Soviet Union and said, here I am, I'd like to live with you.
Yeah. And now I'm stuck. I'm not saying this is an exact correspondence. Obviously, history doesn't repeat. But there are people who, just as there were people who called themselves and thought of themselves as Democrats, for all of their lives and suddenly became supporters of dictatorship the moment the Soviet Union appeared. There are people, it seems to me, on the centre-right who've held to certain principles about liberty and things to do with markets and trade who suddenly seem to have leapt off into a different space. I mean, an obvious case study in this, well, it's an isolated case study, would be our good friend Corey Bernardi, who had gone to Washington in the same way that people went to Moscow and come back a convert to principles that don't, to my mind, resemble old-style conservatism, really.
And you might, I think it's very odd. You might be an altruist, mightn't you? I mean, do you think Mr. Bernardi found his current position in the United States or had it before he went? You know, there are people unkind enough to suggest that he had it before he last stood for Liberal pre-selection.
But realising
that in order to come out with his views, he would be need to have a six-year term in the Senate to provide job security, he best keep that all to himself until he had pre-selection and may have even looked, I don't know, at the possibility of a parliamentary pension.
Yes.
So do you still want to say...
The Soviet Union had mixed motives as well sometime, of course. The Lenin School in Moscow.
Fair enough. I just couldn't let you say went to the United States and came back different.
No, you're quite right. That was a performance, I quite agree. But it was a public performance of conversion.
Now, look, does it, in one way, and it does matter in one way, I know how useful it is to have labels that we use for generalities to try and explain where people's views are. Like these 20 people are centre-left says something. It doesn't mean they all think the same way. So labels have their importance. But in another sense, they're not important at all. Why do we care what label you put on someone, whether you call them conservative or neocon or whatever? I mean, who gives a damn? Isn't the real issue of politics not what the politicians call each other, but what the people think? And has there been a shift there? Rather than what politicians call themselves and whether they've changed their mind, has the public at large, the demos, the people who we are meant to serve, have they not changed their mind about some things?
Well, I think, I'm not sure I 100% agree, but I think about 80% agree with that. I mean, I think how politicians present politics to the public matters too, because we all process politics through the public debate, and politicians have a large role in that. But I agree that you're right. The whole Trump phenomenon in America and its wash over here would not be what it is without the profound disenchantment of parts of the American electorate with political system, the state of America, and the sense of Washington being a swamp and the need to be rescued from politics by a charismatic non-politician. I mean, I think everyone's agreed pretty much in any year other than 2016, Donald Trump would have been a 2 or 3% kind of guy. Last year, he was more like a 45% kind of guy. That was not to do with him, really. I think we can all see that quite clearly. That was to do with deep alienation of parts of the American electorate from the state of the country and the state of politics. I personally, to put it on the record, think that he is no solution at all, and it's turning out to be a bit of a disaster. But nevertheless, you're quite right. He is a canary. In one respect, he's a canary in the coal mine. So to speak, almost literally the coal mine, as it were, since that's one part of his constituency, of course.
Is part of the problem that in so few cases do politicians and journalists in their discussions with each other that get portrayed to the public to bring them into an inclusive debate so rarely say, what's the first principle we're operating from here? I hear interviews and conversations where it's, I think this and I think that. A lot of finger pointing going on, generally press the button and turn it off, because I don't hear enough of, look, the principle we want to put into place, the one to which we want to give value is this one. And here's how we think you can do it and bring someone else in. I don't hear those conversations now. I just hear finger pointing. What about you?
I think that's right. I'm not sure there ever was a golden age when conversations like that happen in exactly that way, but I agree it's very hard to even approximate such a thing at present. And I think one of the reasons why a Trump kind of person can appear plausible when he otherwise wouldn't is he at least appears to be shooting from the hip and talking about the big questions. I think the great problem with the presidency of Obama, as with a great many of our political leaders here, is they have an idea in their heads for what our situation is and the possibilities of moving on from it, but they're lousy at sharing it, and they're so caught up, as you say, in the minutiae of political drama and combat that they never manage to communicate this to the public. So weird though it may seem to outsiders, of course Trump seemed to a lot of Americans as if he was actually finally just including them into a conversation that they thought was happening behind closed doors.
Now you've mentioned in some preliminary discussions about us talking today that people seem to be more motivated by what they hate than what they want. And I agree with that. I've said for a long time, I think Australians, and I'm confining my remarks to that because I don't understand the other cultures to make any comment on them, are angry, consistently angry, more so than when I was young, angry with everything. And so I agree. But what I want to ask is that substantively a position, or have they simply osmosed from the major political parties the game of politics, which is having a go at each other, and which appears to be so much, you know, I don't like you, you don't like me, which one's going to win government? Have the public just osmosed that and become, well, I don't like this and I don't like that? Or is it a substantive position that they're not happy?
No, that's a really good question, Amanda. It'd take hours to sort that one out, wouldn't it? No, I think that goes to the crux of the matter. I think there's a bit of, I think it's partly both. I think there's a common thread, to be honest. I think, in my view, I don't want to sound like a Hallmark greeting card here, but in my view, when hatred replaces argument, it's usually because your own position is not strong. You hate your opponents because you realise the weakness of your own position, or even sometimes the similarity of your own position, or the impossibility of presenting an alternative position which is coherent and credible. I mean, clearly, I would have thought in federal politics in this country right now, the rhetoric of political argument is out of all proportion to the differences between the parties. And the way Bill Shorten performs being opposition leader at the moment is it's chiefly performance. And I agree with you, that flows through to the electorate who kind of emulate this. We all sort of copy it. It's kind of like a kind of mirror sort of thing, I think. But I think also you're right that unless the public are given some clear arguments and told really how things are, I think, you know, it is possible to do this. It isn't possible to do that. The American coal industry is not coming back the way it used to be. That's just a simple fact. Unless the terms of the argument are put out clearly in front of people, the temperature goes up because no one believes there's any road of solution to anything. And no one trusts what the other side is saying, I think. And that's just, I think that's what has so many people, like you and me, politics watchers, so worried about the current climate in this country and elsewhere, is that it resembles the unravelling of parts of a liberal democratic culture, where there's an assumption that there is a kind of civility and where arguments are based on a certain conception of shared values that does seem to be unravelling to some extent. I don't want to sound like, you know, apocalyptic, but to some extent I think that is what's happening.
Well, David, let me leave you with this. As you know, I was on the Commission of Audit some years ago, painted the picture of if there was no change, where debt would be, we'd have to make substantial change. That was a sort of a looming crisis, if you like. It got picked up by the media and others as, well, what crisis? The government of the day didn't want to say we've got a crisis now, perhaps didn't articulate the looming nature of it. And guess what? We've still got the debt because Australians were told, oh, no, everything's okay. Labor didn't want to accept that the debt would go as it was. They didn't want to say, yeah, we did that. And so now we're in this terrible position simply because it wasn't dealt with at the time. And I think a part of why it wasn't dealt with was the nature of politics that we've been discussing, that it's you're in that corner, I'm in that corner, and in the end, for you and I, nothing gets done. But look, you and I can talk about that another time. David Birchall, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Amanda. Take care.
And that was David Birchall from the University of Western Sydney, Counterpoint regular.